Welcome to another edition of the All Souls Forum here on KKFI. This program was recorded on Sunday, October the 6th at the All Souls Unitarian Universalist Church in Kansas City, Missouri. Tonight's speaker is former Kansas City Star columnist and now author Steve Penn. He's going to talk about the Pete O'Neill story, the push for his pardon, and talk about a new book he has written about the former Kansas City Black Panther. Pete O'Neill actually spoke at the All Souls Forum in 1969, as you will hear. Let's have our usual introduction, and we'll jump right into Mr. Penn's subject. So here we go.
Good morning, and welcome to the forum at All Souls Unitarian Universalist Church. We celebrated turning 70 this fall, so we have had a long, long tradition of providing a platform for the discussion of significant issues. Today, our speaker is Steve Penn, who is a former Kansas City Star reporter. We know many of those former reporters and columnists. One of the things that he has become very interested in is the question of Pete O'Neill. When I first moved to Kansas City, there were certain stories that you would hear, and you would hear about different people, and one of the persons that you always heard about was Pete O'Neill. And we're going to hear a lot more about him. Steve has written a book called Case for a Pardon, and I told him to bring a few copies of it, so if anybody wanted to buy one later, so we'll be peddling that afterwards. So again, I invite you to listen to our speaker after half an hour or so, then we'll have a break and have Q&A. So, Steve?
Thank you very much. Like she said, I'm Steve Penn. I'm a former reporter slash columnist with the Kansas City Star, where I worked 31 years. But on May 25th, 1969, the subject of my book, Pete O'Neill, actually spoke to this very congregation here at All Souls. The theme of that forum was Why Revolution? I corresponded with Pete recently, and I asked him what he spoke about. Pete told me that he does not actually recall the topic, Why Revolution? But he told me, quote, looking back from the vantage point of 73 years, he's 73 years old, he said, I would hope that my talk contained some logic and substance and wasn't totally rhetoric. That's the Pete O'Neill that I've grown to know. Extremely honest, retrospective, and extremely mature. Now after 44 years, I'm here, and Pete O'Neill once again speaks to this congregation through my book, Case for a Pardon, the Pete O'Neill story. What really started out strictly as a literary pursuit has transformed and blossomed into an all-out pursuit for justice. By that I mean that my book, Case for a Pardon, the Pete O'Neill story, has really transformed now into a justice for Pete campaign. By that I mean a group of us, including Congressman Reverend Emmanuel Cleaver, Alvin Sykes, and Reverend Samuel Mann, we are actively pursuing the proper legal way to allow Pete O'Neill to return to the States. And I'm proud that my book has become the motivation and the catalyst for such an effort. First, let me give you a bit of context and a bit of background history. Pete O'Neill was born July 27, 1940. Not too far away from here, off of 12th Street and the Paseo in the old T.B. Watkins housing project. After the riots of 68, following the death of MLK, Pete O'Neill emerged as the leader of the Kansas City chapter of the Black Panthers. For a year and a half, he waged his little mini-revolution on the streets of Kansas City. His mini-revolution involved taking on a racist church located in the black community which wouldn't allow African Americans to become members. He disrupted a beauty pageant which was exploiting African-American women. He is credited with starting the very first breakfast program. You remember the breakfast program which fed hundreds of children each day, a program which eventually became modeled throughout the nation. And, of course, Pete O'Neill took on his main target, the Kansas City Police Department's mistreatment of the African-American community. During that time, Pete O'Neill also made what I call the Panther Mafia connection in Kansas City, and the book explores all of those tales as well. Finally, in 1969, the autumn of that year, Pete O'Neill was charged with transferring a weapon across state line. It was a felony because he had previously been convicted of a felony when he was younger. Pete O'Neill has contended all this time that he did not carry that weapon across state line. Out on bond, Pete and Charlotte climb into the trunk of a waiting car. I can't make this stuff up. They then boarded a plane that took them to New York. First, they spent a few months in Sweden before traveling to Algiers. In Algiers, Pete hooked up with Eldridge Cleaver, the author of the book Soul on Ice. The two men headed up the international section of the Panthers for several years until relations with the Algerian government soured. Eventually, Pete and Charlotte made their way first to Dar es Salaam in East Africa. They eventually settled in Arusha in East Africa, and Pete and Charlotte became quite nifty with their hands. So after they arrived, they did a series of things to make money. Pete made cakes and was selling them all over East Africa. He raised chickens. He had a chicken farm. He even met a man, and he borrowed his mother's recipe and was branding his own brand of sausage across East Africa. Pete's gourmet smoked sausage. Eventually, Pete and Charlotte moved to a 3-acre piece of property. They built with their own hands this viable compound. It has classrooms and dormitories that I actually stayed in. In the 90s, the couple started the United African Alliance Community Center, which they call the UAACC. Each day, young people from throughout Pete's village attend classes at his compound, learning everything from computer classes to sewing. Volunteers from the States and Tanzania converge on his property to instruct his students. It's truly heartwarming to see, and I actually experienced it by going there last year. Now, top off all of those accomplishments with one more. Several years ago, Pete adopted 23 Tanzanian children. I've got one, and my hands are full. He's got 23 kids. Let's multiply a cold times 23. Let's multiply a headache times 23. I'm telling you, the guy is busy. Extremely busy. But the kids are provided education, clothing, a roof over their heads, and what's more, Pete provides each of these kids with a world-class education. These kids are becoming fluent in English. He takes them on excursions, like to the Indian Ocean. Pete's ultimate goal is to send each one of these kids to college. He'd like for them eventually to reach their potential. Pete has turned out to be an amazing man, is what I'm trying to impart. Part of the book explains the relationship between Pete and Geronimo Pratt. Geronimo Pratt was the leader of the Black Panthers in Los Angeles, and he was sentenced to federal prison for a murder that he contended he did not commit. Convicted upon the basis of the testimony of a paid informant, Geronimo eventually was exonerated and released from federal custody. The feds paid Geronimo $4.5 million for his false imprisonment. When Geronimo got out, one of the first things he did was call Pete. He called him, he said, "Pete, what can I do to help you?" Pete told him that his village could use clean running water. Pratt provided O'Neill with $10,000 that O'Neill used to hire a well to dig this well in his village. Now, what's amazing, and I saw this in action, is every day of the year, you see people from all over Pete's village converging on his property, filling their jugs with this water to clean their clothes, to feed their children, to drink the water. It's just one of the many things that the couple has done to provide for their village. In the 1990s, Kansas City elected Kansas City Mayor Emanuel Cleaver, who advocated for a presidential pardon for Pete. Unfortunately, his efforts fell short when Clinton became embroiled in his own scandals. Then, several years ago, an attorney named Paul Magnarella started working on Pete's case pro bono. He's offered the court several strong arguments for an appeal. Those same arguments are now part of a potential appeal that has been placed into the hands of U.S. Attorney General Eric Holder. Unfortunately, the appeals in the courts here have been shot down at least twice. But the appeals are interesting. They argue that J. Edgar Hoover used illegal wiretaps to silence Pete and the Panthers. The appeals also contend that illegal wiretaps were obtained in reference to Pete O'Neill. And the appeals contend that O'Neill should never have been ever charged with a crime, since the charge should have been expunged after Pete completed his sentence and turned 21, as is the case with every other felon or convicted person in America. And most contentiously, he argues that O'Neill was convicted based upon the testimony of a paid informant, just as in Geronimo Pratt's conviction, was overturned on the very same things. Those are just some of the arguments that Mr. Magnarella has based his arguments on. Now we have renewed legal efforts that are being led by Alvin Sykes, who has been named the victim's advocate for Pete. He believes that instead of pushing for a presidential pardon, which doesn't mean admitting guilt and apologizing, our efforts should be focused on some sort of commutation of his sentence. I'm going to read a little section of my book. Who is Pete O'Neill, now 72, and what did he do? What did he really do to anger the federal government so much that he can never come back to America? Never. Well, there's really no short answer to that question. Pete O'Neill did a lot of things, some right and some wrong. This book is an attempt to tell the whole story, not just the pages that deal with the good or the events that make him look like a saint. The next pages tell the good, the bad, and the downright ugly side of Pete O'Neill. He was truly what you would call a mixed bag. Pete O'Neill was the chairman of the Kansas City chapter of the Black Panthers Party. He served from the late 1968 until he was accused of taking a shotgun across state line, a federal offense since he had previously been convicted of a felony as a youth. He was found guilty by a jury and sentenced to 4 years in federal penitentiary. While out on bond, he fled the country. He first fled to Algeria and then to Tanzania. This year, 2013, marks his 43rd year in exile. He lives in Arusha, Tanzania, at the base of Mount Meru and Mount Kilimanjaro with his wife, Charlotte. His son, Malcolm X, and his daughter, Anne, grew up in Arusha, but now live in Kansas City. O'Neill has long served out his punishment. He's been in a type of isolation, in a sort of cage, unable to see his mother, attend his father's funeral, unable to enjoy the city he was born in. Now his only hope of return may be in the form of a presidential pardon, and that's a tall request indeed. It's the ultimate long shot. It may or not ever happen. What is clear is that without a full explanation of his life, with every section examined and reexamined, it will probably never happen. This is that autopsy. Hopefully for the first time, readers will gain the full truth about Pete O'Neill. Readers will be able to separate the facts from the fiction and what he did and didn't do. And each individual reader can draw his or her own conclusion. Does he or doesn't he deserve to return? The bottom line is this. Pete O'Neill has now been in exile for 43 years. That's 43 years away from his mother, who is from Kansas City, who now is 93. That's 43 years away from his daughter and son who live here. And that's 43 years away from the very neighborhood that he grew up in, his original tribe. I contend that 43 years is an extremely long time. More than half Pete's life has been spent in exile for a crime he allegedly did not commit. I would argue, and I hope you agree with me, that the time has come for Pete O'Neill's exile to come to an end. The time to end this saga is now. Pete is now turned 73. He turned 73 on July 27th. The man is in the final phase of what I consider an extraordinary life. And Pete O'Neill, in my opinion, has more than paid his debt to society. And as Alvin Sykes puts it, it's more important that Pete O'Neill forgive America rather than America forgive Pete O'Neill. People ask me all the time what they can do to help. Well, there are several ways. The first is to purchase a book. The effort also funds some of our grassroots legal efforts that are underway. And secondly, we have petitions, and we are asking people to sign them. And we believe that if enough signatures are gathered, it will send a signal to authorities in Washington that we are extremely serious about our efforts. The book is actually being sold through Barnes & Noble and is also available at www.caseforapardon.com. That's www.caseforapardon.com. If you go there, you can keep up with our latest events and speaking engagements. Again, on behalf of Pete and his marvelous wife, Charlotte, I would like to thank you all for allowing me to come and speak. Thank you very much.
You're listening to the All Souls Forum here on KKFI, talking about former Kansas City Black Panther Pete O'Neill and his quest to return home. We've got some messages for you. Let's do those, and we'll have a longer than usual question and answer period coming right up on the All Souls Forum.
You all are invited to enjoy an evening of dinner, live music, and theater at Kansas City, Kansas Community College. They're having a Night in the Heights event sponsored by KCKCC in El Centro. The event begins at 5:30 p.m. Saturday, October 19th with a reception, and then dinner follows at 6 p.m. with the musical In the Heights, starting at 8 p.m. All proceeds go to benefit the music and theater departments at KCKCC. For tickets or further information, call 913-288-7504 or go online to kckcc.edu. This is a public service announcement from 90.1 FM, KKFI, Kansas City Community Radio.
Next time on LA Theater Works, Two best friends square off in a high-stakes game of truth, identity, and romance.
I'm in love with Gwendolyn. I've come up to town expressly to propose to her.
I thought you would come up for pleasure. I call that business.
The Importance of Being Earnest by Oscar Wilde. Next time on LA Theatre Works.
Wednesday evening at 7, right after the All Souls Forum.
Is there a shortage of high-tech workers? Do we need to raise the quota for high-tech guest workers? Do they undercut wages of Americans? We'll find out on this week's Heartland Labor Forum, where we'll also revisit the Peabody Patriot Shuffle and learn about how the United Mine Workers and Supporters forced Peabody to rewrite its Patriot Act. That's Heartland Labor Forum, Thursday, 6 p.m., rebroadcast Friday, 5 a.m.
This week on The Bioneers, Revolution from the Heart of Nature.
Young Women United demanded that we do not consider poor young women of color as people that can be just thrown away by society.
I'm Neil Harvey. It's Women Changing the Story, Mother Bears, Polar Bears, and Women's Leadership on The Bioneers.
Friday morning at 9:30, right after Between the Lines.
We have a little more time than usual for our Q&A period. So if some of you have remembrances of that time period in Kansas City, we'll cut a little slack in terms of being able to make a few comments. I want to say something first, that one of the things that appealed to me about Pete is, and the connection with the church, is I was not here at the time. I moved to Kansas City in 72. But reading about some of the things, as you know, many of our churches, including ours, are predominantly white, but the church, one of the churches he was especially concerned about were some of the ones that did not permit African Americans to be citizens and had heavily white suburbanites who continued to come to their old church but were in the middle of a black neighborhood who had pretty much no contact with the community. And so some of the Black Panthers, from what I read in his book and elsewhere, decided to basically have, I'll call them kind of takeovers or sit-ins of churches. So Sunday morning during a service at the United Methodist Church on Linwood, a group of the Black Panthers entered, came up, took the mic, gave the minister a copy of their demands and asked him to read them, which he did not do, said he would at some other time. They came back. They left peacefully, came back another time, and as I said, Pete took the mic and started to read his demands, and things kind of escalated from there. And so I was thinking about us, what would we do? Probably, I'm thinking if that happened, we'd say, okay, what do you have to say? At least I hope that's what we would say. So now in our questions and answers, just please ask a question, and again, I've got a little bit more of statements this time than usual, and please just give everybody a chance to speak.
Yes, go right ahead.
Could you please talk a little bit about the trial itself and tell me what has persuaded you that he is not guilty of what he was convicted of?
Well, a couple of things. The trial was probably a 7-day trial. It started in October of 69, ended up, I think P was eventually convicted at the end of October, ironically, this very month. Pete O'Neill went into the restroom. He was standing next to one of the members of the jury, and one of them came and told him, look, Pete, we think you're going to be able to get off here. We don't see you getting convicted. Anyway, he was convicted. Pete O'Neill has contended that he did not take that weapon. Here's the reason why I believe in his innocence. The gun wasn't even on Pete O'Neill. He was not arrested. A lot of people have this perception that Pete O'Neill was arrested with a weapon. Nothing could be further from the truth. A gentleman in the Panther Party was arrested with the weapon. Pete O'Neill had never had this particular weapon that he's been charged with. What happened is he took a picture that appeared in the Kansas City Star with this particular firearm. His wife contends the gun never even worked. Now, One of the contentions is that a firearm isn't a firearm unless it shoots, unless it fires. Pete O'Neill's wife has contended that this weapon never worked. So, once again, Pete O'Neill is innocent, I believe, of this particular charge. He has contended all of this time that he did not take this weapon. He wasn't arrested with it. It's just a situation where the feds found out where he purchased this weapon from, went back, found out the purchase record of it, went back, interviewed the people who he purchased it from, found the weapon, made their case, found the picture. The picture was taken in Kansas, Missouri. So the assumption was, well, this weapon started out in Kansas City, Kansas. It had to have somehow made its way to Kansas, Missouri, where he took this photograph. That's the only evidence. That's all their case. That is the case. Question.
I can understand why someone would like to come home, you know, and would like to be back, especially with family. But it sounds like to me that Pete O'Neill has established himself as quite a citizen in Africa. So does he, and I'm kind of playing devil's advocate here, does he just want to be able to return as a free man? And would he stay in Africa? Or would he, do you think he would actually transfer his whole family and his 23 kids back to the United States? I can't
That's a very good question. Extremely good question. And I pretty much know the answer to it. Pete O'Neill would love to come back to visit his neighborhood. He would love to see his mother, who is 93 years old and lives in John Knox Village. He would love to see his daughter and his sons here. He has two brothers here. He would love to see them too. But you are absolutely correct. He has 23 Watoto. Those are, and that's the Swahili word for children. He would not want to come back to live in Kansas City. His home is in Africa. He has clearly made his claim that that is his home. That is his original, that is his current tribe. So you're absolutely correct. Pete O'Neill would love to come back, visit, see the progress, see his old neighborhood, visit his mother, visit his daughter and son, visit his brothers, but he would not want to live here. So we are fighting for his right to be able to just come back and visit.
I'm curious about the African part of this, why he ended up first in Algiers and then in Tanzania, and how he's accepted there, and what the difference was in his reception in those two places. So I'm just interested in the whole African piece of this and how they view him and how they accept him.
Well, that's another great question. When Pete got to Algiers, he linked up with Eldridge Cleaver, who was the former Minister of Information for the L.A. chapter of the Black Panthers. They ran the international section of the Panthers. But after a while, after about a year, their relationship started to sour. The Algerian government, who had been allowing these expatriates to seek refuge in their country, just didn't deem it as a very positive move. So Pete O'Neill eventually got out of Algeria, eventually moving to Dar es Salaam. It was their first place in East Africa they moved, and then over into Tanzania, in Arusha. In Arusha, Pete has really become a respected elder. He is like a hero. He goes to the supermarket, and it's just amazing. I actually went shopping with him. It is just amazing. He will walk into a grocery store, and he'll say a couple of things to a few cashiers, and they will get everything he needs, put it in a basket for him. He walks out of the store. I'm like, what are you doing? He gets out of the store, and About 5 minutes later, you see guys with boxes bringing food to his car. I said, are you going to eventually pay? He says, oh, yeah, eventually. They put these boxes, probably maybe 10 boxes in his car. Pete exchanges money with them. He's like a hero. He's like, the guy like walks on water. I'm telling you, he's treated extremely well by the Tanzanian people. They really regard him as royalty.
Steve, I read your book, and I thank you for writing it. The thing that impressed me, that I learned from it, was the amount of anger and frustration as a young, these young black men in Kansas City, and the kinds of awful languages that you reported they used in regard to the police and all that. The question I wanted to ask you is there something that we're not conscious of or that we haven't included in our efforts to reduce violence in Kansas City? Is there something there, that anger or that frustration? Does it have anything to do with the situation now in Kansas City about violence from what you reported in your book?
Sure.
I don't know if that's a clear question.
Absolutely. And I think I have a good solution to that. Bring Pete O'Neill back to Kansas City. Let him talk to some of these young men on these streets. Pete O'Neill has an incredible message for young people. And let this gentleman come back. Talk to these young people on these streets. I would bet you would see a reduction in crime. If this gentleman could come back and talk to our kids in an open forum, because what he's been through, what he survived on the other end of this is truly, he's on the other side of all of this, and he truly has a strong story to tell. I would think that he'd be an effective advocate against young violence. Question.
Yes. First, I'd like to thank you for coming today and telling us about your book and about Pete O'Neill. This may be an impossible question, but I'm just wondering, based on what you've learned about him, what his life might have been like if he had not been charged with this one crime. Where do you think he was headed in his life, and what kind of a contribution he might have made to society? What might he have done to help us handle racial conflicts and friction and educational problems, and maybe even some international conflicts that have come up over the years? Was he doing anything that gives you a clue as to what his contribution might have been to our lives and to our nation if he had remained in this country all these years?
It's a very good question, extremely good question. The guy was headed in the direction of effectuating change. He was trying to stop what we know to be true in terms of police brutality. He was trying to effectuate change with police brutality. We know he was trying to feed starving children through the breakfast program. We know that every morning they were getting up, going to kitchens, food kitchens, setting up. They were feeding, I believe it was 750 children a day in Kansas City at one point. Those are the kinds of things that Pete O'Neill would have continued to advocate for. Those are the kinds of things that he would have been. And you know what? I don't really know what type of profession would have been best for him. Maybe a politician. I don't know. But he certainly wouldn't have been limited to anything. And his potential would have been immeasurable in this particular town. As we well know, his third cousin grew up to be the U.S. congressman from this particular district, from the very same family. So we do know that Congressman Emanuel Cleaver often tells me that Pete O'Neill's life could have been his life, because he could have gone the exact same direction that Pete O'Neill did. He could have been a radical as well, but he chose the mainstream political system. And so maybe Pete would have become a politician. It's just hard to say. Question.
I'm not very good at remembering names, but maybe you know that person who wrote a book who said, "Choice of weapons." That was the admonishment of his mother. He became a famous photographer in the United States. At the time he was rebelling, the mother told him, "Choose a weapon, because the consequences are immense." So he chose learning, understanding people, observing, and became a writer, a photographer, a movie maker. You know that man. Yes.
Absolutely.
Now, compare Gordon Parks' choice of weapons with Pete O'Neill. What did he do in Africa to redeem himself?
Very good question. You know, I don't believe, and I say it in the book, that Pete O'Neill doesn't seek redemption. He doesn't ask us for our forgiveness for what he did. But the point is, some people like Pete O'Neill deserve redemption whether they ask for it or not. This is a gentleman who has gone on to raise 23 Tanzanian children, educate them, clothe them, raise them. I don't know many people from the United States that will adopt 23 children. And what's interesting is many of these kids come from deprived circumstances. Their parents come to Pete, they say, "Look, I can't raise my child. My daughter can't raise her son. Would you take my child in and raise him?" I actually saw a mother, a grandmother, at Pete's door. She begged him, "Please, would you take my son in? My daughter can't raise my particular child. Would you?" The brother thought about it for 3 or 4 days. He commiserated with his sister. He talked to his mother. But eventually, Pete O'Neill acquiesced. He took that child in. That's the kind of guy he is. That is the guy that I am fighting for. That is the guy that I would like to bring home to Kansas City. Question.
This is a kind of a hypothetical question, but I'm sure you had some contact and interaction with the peers of Pete O'Neill through his time. And if there was a time warp and they just were able to fast forward to today and view their assess the situation as it is today, What would be their reflections and thoughts for looking back on what they were fighting for?
Good question. Pete O'Neill is very retrospective. He looks back on his era, and he realizes that a lot of the means that he went about were not particularly perfect. He realizes that, unlike he said in my opening remarks, if he was just all about rhetoric, you know, that's, as you well know, rhetoric is rhetoric. But if he was about something of substance, that is what he wanted to be about. That is what he is about. That was what he was about. And the guy's has become a great advocate for children now. That's what his life is about, these kids. And he wants to make an impact with them. Over the Easter holiday last year, he was so overjoyed when I talked to him about taking these 23 children to the Indian Ocean. It's all about letting them. He had been telling, even with the months that I was there, he always likes to excite these kids. He tells them, "Look, we're going to go to the ocean and we're going to see a fish bigger than this house." And I asked Pete, Why do you embellish? Why do you tell your stories like that? He says, well, it's kind of like a soup. I put a little salt, a little pepper in it. I want to spice it up. I said, that'll do it. That will get kids energized and excited about seeing the Indian Ocean. That's the kind of guy he is. His wife, I haven't spoken on her. She is just as wonderful. She has become an artist, a singer, and is in extremely demand all across East Africa. She performs. She's quite the performer. She's made quite a good life for herself over there. She is allowed to come back and forth. She can come back to America. When she started inquiring as to her passport status, there were no restrictions on her. So she can come back, advocate for him, advocate for my book, and she will be back in February. So stay tuned. Charlotte Pete's wife will be back in February. We'll be having a series of events based on her re-arrival.
I'm old enough to remember the 60s, and I was here when Pete O'Neill spoke the first time. And I was extremely proud of our church to allow a forum for Pete. However, I also know that there was a lot of fear at that time and fear of the Black Panthers. Mm-hmm. So I'm guessing that a lot of the reaction to Pete was in fear of what mm-hmm. these young black, angry black men were going to do, mm-hmm. even though they were doing some of these fine things for the community. Mm-hmm. There was a tension there of mm-hmm. what's going to happen next. Looking back, what do you think the accomplishments of the Black Panthers has been over the years? And, you know, are there any failings of their program? Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. You know, what's the evaluation today of what they were doing?
They were doing some amazing things. You're right. It's a two-sided coin because they were sort of ruling with intimidation, with fear. Everywhere they went, people feared what the Black Panthers would do. Everywhere they spoke, people feared the repercussions of it. You know, will there be a riot? Will there be bombs thrown? Everywhere they went, there was fear. Whether they spoke on the steps of City Hall or in the pulpit of Linwood United Methodist Church, there was fear. But at the same time, on the other side, they were able to accomplish many, many, many things. And as Congressman Cleaver puts it, without the Black Panthers, there would not have been the push to go toward the mainstream, which was MLK. And Congressman Cleaver believes that the Black Panthers pushed mainstream America to MLK because that was one alternative. King was the other alternative. And without that advocacy, without that fear, the push may not have been made to MLK as easily as it was, especially mainstream African Americans. We rallied around MLK because we saw the extreme on the far left was the Pete O'Neill was too extreme. That wasn't something that we wanted for America and for the United States. So Reverend Cleaver believes that we were pushed to MLK by the advocacy of a Pete O'Neill. And so that is a major accomplishment. That is, if you push a movement towards a winning movement, that's advocacy. That's pushing a great body of people to accept another person.
Since that time, much of America has become aware of what was going on behind the scenes, both with the FBI as well as local law enforcement. Can you give us a profile of some of the incidences here in Kansas City at that time between the police and the Black Panthers, but also between the police and protesters in terms of bringing more rights to African Americans here locally?
Well, probably the most famous incident involved Pete and the Black Panthers, and this is very much detailed in my book. Probably one of the most famous incidents involved the Black Panthers were outside the police chief Clarence Kelly's office. This is one afternoon. The Panthers heard that there was a press conference. And they did have a Black Panther newspaper. So they were, quote-unquote, legitimate, quote-unquote, journalists. They tried to get into this press conference. And by get in this press conference, I should probably say, they tried to barge in the police chief's press conference. Needless to say, the police chief was having none of it. And he armed his office outside of his office with about five or six police officers. Pete O'Neill and a couple of Panthers got off the elevator. Pete O'Neill told the guard at the door that they wanted to enter the press conference. The police told them, no, you're not getting in. Pete tried to force his way into the press conference. As he did, the police officers beat Pete beyond submission. There was blood on the floor, lots of blood. They beat one of his fellow Panthers so badly that he ended up having brain issues later and passed away. That's just one of many incidents. For instance, there was a time when, this is in the book as well, the very first moment Pete went, they weren't even the Black Panthers at this point. They went to seek some funding from an organization called the United Way. And they walked in. They were wearing Black Panther regalia. They had their Tams on, their black leather jackets. And they so they were a significant sight when they walked in the room. But there was a woman speaking at the particular time. She was the wife of a Kansas City police officer. And she told Pete to shut the blank up. And Pete was mumbling under his breath. Anyway, she ended up cursing Pete out in a public way. After the forum, Pete O'Neill went straight to the police department. He told Chief Clarence Kelly, please have this woman charged with disturbing the peace. The police department relented, and they charged this police officer's wife with disturbing the peace. The trial came up a couple weeks later, and Pete O'Neill with his advocates went to court, but to no avail. His particular petition was denied. The woman got off on this particular charge. And at that very moment, Pete O'Neill decided, a tried mainstream, now it's time to start my revolution. And that's how Pete O'Neill started the KC Panthers of the Black Panther Party. That's how he got started. That's what led him into this. And as they say, the rest is history. Questions?
I don't know if anybody else was at the meeting down at the Central Library. This same kind of thing. The reason I asked that question was a friend of mine at that meeting and got up and told how the work of the Panthers with the children in Kansas City at that time, they had, I don't know, a breakfast thing or something with the That's children. Cool. She had taken her child down just to see what it was like. She was so impressed that she took both children down, and she said it really changed her life, that experience. Mm-hmm. So what I'm thinking was, if we could just, if at that time we could have approached the thing with a more human, let's talk with each other, mm-hmm. Then I thought, well, how about now? One of our legislators is having a big thing about violence. And you know who's one of the leading people there is Chief Kelly. I don't think you could put those two men in the same room. I mean, Chief, from what happened.
Chief Kelly has passed.
Oh, really?
Yes, he's passed away.
Mm-hmm. See, mm-hmm. I was thinking, mm-hmm. wouldn't it be great if we could have brought Pete back? Not with a public thing, maybe, but just even to be part of that discussion.
Absolutely. He would love that.
But then I thought that would never work.
He would love being part of something like that. And I would love him being something like being part of something like that.
Maybe I'm just as bad one way as the other, though. Anyway, thank you.
You're welcome. The law is what's prohibiting Pete from ever coming back and participating in a forum like this. If he came back, the minute he would get off the plane in whatever country, it could be France, it could be Great Britain, it wouldn't even matter. Whatever country that we have an extradition treaty, if he would land in that country, he immediately would be remanded into federal custody and would be tossed into Leavenworth for 4 years. There's no question. He would go to prison for 4 years immediately. They wouldn't even pass go immediately. So, and there would be time on top of that 4 years. Pete O'Neill also fled the country while he was out on bond. So those charges would also be compounded too as well. So you're facing 4 years in federal penitentiary for a crime he contends he didn't commit. And also the compounded time for leaving while on bond, too, as well. So, you know, he's looking probably at a minimum of 6 years in federal custody. Questions? Well, once again, thank you all extremely very much for allowing me to come speak to you. And we will have books in the back for sale as well. So, thank you.
You've been listening to former Kansas City Star columnist and now author Steve Penn talking about Pete O'Neill, the push for his pardon, and the hope that he will return home to Kansas City. Hope you enjoyed that. If you were not alive during that era, you now know a lot more than you did about black activism in Kansas City. This program was recorded on Sunday, October the 6th at the All Souls Unitarian Universalist Church in Kansas City, Missouri. The show is produced and edited for broadcast each week by Barry Lee. Special thank you to Rita Norton and the staff at All Souls who help us produce this program each week for you. Tune in again next Wednesday at 6 p.m. for another All Souls Forum right here on 90.1 FM, KKFI, Kansas City Community Radio.